Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care, on the web at aecf.org.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting Songs of Ascension by Meredith Monk and Vocal Ensemble with visual elements by Ann Hamilton on Saturday, April 4th. More information is available online at krannertcenter.com. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Trophy Time in Champaign, with plaques and promotional products to recognize all occasions from athletic endeavors and musical moments to business achievements. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies. Additional information available on the web at trophytime.com.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. You'll also find us at 90.9 FM HD2. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. You know the warning labels on cigarette packaging? In the words of our guest this afternoon, they are a killer marketing tool for the tobacco industry. Could it be that those dire warnings spur smokers to light up? Well, our guest this afternoon is Martin Lindstrom, and he is a global branding expert who advises top executives of companies, including McDonald's Corporation, Procter & Gamble, Microsoft, and Disney. And he is the author, most recently, of Biology, Truth and Lies About Why We Buy. In 2004, he launched a huge marketing study, but this study did not track sales or survey consumers. It looked into the brains of consumers. It was the single largest neuromarketing study ever conducted. It involved brain scans of close to 2,200 people from 5 countries as they were exposed to various ads, logos, commercials, brands, and products. Biology, Martin Lindstrom's latest book, is published by Doubleday, and you'll find our guest online at www.martinlindstrom.com. Martin Lindstrom, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Great to be on the show.
So tell us about the smokers and the effect the warning labels had on them as they underwent these brain scans.
Well, let me take you a step back first and put things into perspective. In fact, we as human beings are smoking 10 million cigarettes every minute across the world. So this is not a phenomenon which is disappearing. In fact, we believe now that we're smoking 13% more over the last 3 years. That is, of course, including China and Eastern Europe. But it's pretty frightening numbers. And based on that, I asked myself, how come we smoke more, not less? Because, first of all, we know it's not healthy. Secondly, advertising is really banned across the world. And thirdly, we can't even smoke indoor anymore. Mm-hmm. So that's the reason why I wanted to find out what is the true effect. And I looked at those health warnings and said, hey, there's something wrong with this. So what we did was to recruit smokers from across the world, and we scanned their brains using something called fMRI. While we were scanning their brains, we looked into a region in the brain called the nucleus accumbens. Now, the nucleus accumbens, for those of you which are not familiar with that region of the brain, it is the pleasure center or the craving spot. And basically, it lights up as a fireball whenever you are thinking about cigarettes, at least if you are a smoker, or if you like alcohol, if you're into gambling or drugs. So that is the region we looked into as we're exposing those smokers for all sorts of different stimuli, everything from cigarette packs, but also we had a lot of control stimuli involved in the experiment. And what we learned is exactly what you said. I was totally shocked, and so was my scientist team in Oxford, UK, to learn that when people see those gruesome health warnings, not just the ones running here in North America, but also the one running in Europe, which are even more dramatic than the one we know here, well, people actually are encouraged to smoke in their brain. In fact, the brain and the nucleus accumbens is firing up as a fireball. And that is probably the first time ever we've had an evidence showing that those health warnings have the total opposite effect. They, in fact, encourage people to smoke more.
Yet, here's something interesting, too. Most of the smokers you studied said on a questionnaire that the warning labels worked.
Yeah, and that's really interesting you're pointing that out, because what we learned throughout the entire biology study was that whenever people admittedly said something, typically, if not in all cases, what they said was a lie. It's not because they lied, actually. They're not just aware of it. So when people said to us, really, I'm really affected by those health warnings, guess what? They were not affected by them at all. And if they said, I'm seriously affected by them, they actually were not. And obviously, so it's kind of interesting to see that people were saying one thing and the opposite was typically taking the place. And it was not just for smoking. It was the same for ads, the same for even if we said to people, are you going to buy that brand? And people say no. We could see in the brain they actually said yes. So that's what's so interesting about our brain, that we, in principle, are controlled by our subconscious part of the brain. And that accounts for about 85% of everything we do every day throughout our lives.
So we're more emotional and less rational than we think.
Well, yeah, we are. And let me just ask you, what do you think you are? Are you highly rational or highly emotional every day?
Well, after reading biology, I know that I'm a pretty emotional kind of character.
And, well, you know, it's interesting because do you knock on wood, for example?
Yeah, but kind of just as a joke.
Well, you know, you still do it, right?
Yeah, I do it.
Yeah. And see, the interesting thing is that more than 80% of people around the Western world is doing that. When I ask them why, most people are saying, I don't know, I just do it somehow and feel deeply guilty about doing it. But if they don't do it, they feel guilty too.
Yeah. Well, you know, also, it doesn't it tell us something about, like, say, the success and then great fall of Bernard Madoff or the financial crisis, the mortgage crisis?
Well, it does. And what's so interesting about the financial crisis is I would claim that if the media were not as effectful as it's been during this round of the crisis, we would not have seen a crisis to the same extent as we've seen right now, because it is what I define as self-fulfilling prophecy. We talk about how fearful we will be when the fear is arriving and the crisis is happening, and that fear then becomes even bigger because now we can see that people are more fearful because of it, and then in the end of the day, the recession is taking place. And I think what's happening right now in our society, unfortunately, is that we are very much driven by fear, particularly here in North America, where we're consuming 10 times as many drugs as in the rest of the world per capita. So what's interesting is that we as consumers are very much driven by fear, not just in politics, but also in the way products and brands are sold, and right now because of the recession as well.
I would like you to talk with us about a fascinating example of emotionality and how our brains work in the area of, this involves the area of product placement, Coke and Ford and American Idol.
Yes, what was interesting was that we actually learned that when we analyzed American Idol, again using brain science and scanned literally the viewers as they're watching the American Idol show, we were stunned to learn that one of the most expensive product placements in history, in fact, was a total waste of money. You have to remember that Coca-Cola, Ford, and AT&T spending each around $26 million every year to sponsor probably the most popular TV show of our time. Now, what we learned was that Coca-Cola actually was doing pretty well. They have developed something called the Red Room. It makes sense in our brain. The brain is saying, hey, no, you're sitting relaxing, it's refreshing, that's Coca-Cola. I understand it, I buy into it, I remember it. And so did our brain scans tell us. Well, then it came to AT&T, and when we were doing this experiment, we did it on Singular, before they're acquired by AT&T. Again, the brain was saying, hey, pretty relevant, you know? You have to dial up on a phone number and cast a vote. Makes sense for me. So people did indeed remember AT&T or Singular. But then came the big shocker, Ford. Ford actually did something we'd never seen before. Instead of increasing the awareness of the brand and the emotional engagement with the brand, people literally deleted the brand in the brain. We've never seen that before. So when people started to see the show, they actually remember the brand more than when they were finished watching the show. And that had a price tag of $26 million.
Mm-hmm. What does this mean for the future of traditional advertising?
It means a lot. I think there's three overall things which I've learned from this. First of all, that when it comes to product placement and sponsorships, it absolutely has to be in a context. And if you take the football stadiums where you have those banners advertising everything from the local butcher to the bank, do you know what? Our brain cannot capture that. It really can't remember it because the brain is saying, is it relevant for me to understand the story of the game? If not, it will simply delete it. So we now know that product placement and sponsorships and whatever it is a waste of money in most of the cases. And that means this whole new discipline has to change dramatically or else we'll basically just stop working from now on. The second thing we learned is that subconscious information is much more powerful than we thought in the past. And that means the whole concept of subliminal advertising, in fact, exist, and I would like to tell you more about that in a second. And the last thing we learned from this whole concept is, this is really interesting, we learned that the senses actually have an enormous power in us making a choice of what brand we want to buy, not just the sense of sight, but in particular the sense of sound, smell, touch, and taste. So these are some of the major findings we found from the Biology Project.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Martin Lindstrom, author most recently of Biology, that's B-U-Y, Ology, Truth and Lies About Why We Buy. He's a global branding expert who advises top executives of companies around the world. We're talking this afternoon with him about why we buy. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. If we could go back to Coke for a moment and American Idol, I thought this was really interesting that Coke really had it right on the money in terms of it inserted itself. It inserted the product into the narrative and the drama of what was going on. And we know as human beings, we're all drawn to a good story, right?
Well, exactly. And what's so interesting is that if you take a look at a lot of movies today, they're packed with product placement. I saw a Sylvester Stallone movie the other day, believe it or not. It was called Driven. And that had 103 product placements throughout the movie. That is the same as one ad every minute throughout the whole movie. I should receive money from watching that. But, you know, what's interesting is, if you ask me right now, Martin, do you remember any of those ads or those brands? I have no clue about it. So what our brain does to survive, not just with brands, but everything else, is to go in survival mode. I met a person the other day which had been in Cuba. He told me as he was walking down the main street in Cuba, he felt his whole mind was relieved. He didn't feel stressed or anything. And I said, why? He said, probably because there's no brand around, literally no brand. So my brain did not have to render anything, he said to me. And I think he was spot on the money. Because what our brain does to survive is to cut out everything which is not relevant for that story I'm taking part of. And guess what? 99.9% of all ads are not relevant for what I'm doing right now.
Let's take a call now. A listener joining us this afternoon on a cell phone, line one. Hi. Line one?
Yes, please. I have a question concerning the concept of political propaganda and religious education or propaganda and this business of implanting thoughts and thinking of people, if that's possible. And I will disconnect and listen on the radio. Thank you very
much.
Well, listen, it's a very good question you have there. Let me just give you two different answers to it. Politics and advertising and manipulation. It is a very sexy topic, to be honest. What's interesting about it is that we can see that fear really have been the main tool for politicians over the last decades, if not more, to persuade us to cast a vote. We can actually see that if you take President Johnson, when he won his election many years ago, he actually had an ad called the Daisy ad. You may recall it. It was the one where a little girl was counting down as she was picking the leaves from a daisy. Now, what was interesting was it showed an A-bomb, and people literally hated that ad. Guess what? Johnson was winning the election. Now, there's another ad when President W. Bush was winning his election in 2004 called The Wolf. There you saw some wolf passing over the borders. And again, the voiceover was saying that this was the terrorism attacking the United States of America. Now, those two ads were scanned using fMRI to see what the voters' opinions were as they were watching those. And what was interesting was, no matter if you're a Republican or Democrat, the fear area, the amygdala in the brain was activated. And it basically showed that people hated those ads when they were answering later on if they liked them or not. But in the end of the day, both groups of people actually wanted to cast a vote for that particular politician. And that's interesting because that shows how powerful fear is. So that's the first answer. Now, the second answer to religion, this is fascinating too, because we actually, for the biology project, were scanning people belonging to the faith of Christianity to understand what regions in the brains are activated as I'm exposed for a picture of Virgin Mary or a cross or a church or whatever. Then we also scanned people who were strong fans of brands, brands like Apple, Harley Davidson, Hello Kitty, Ferrari, that type of brands. Now, guess what we learned? We had to learn that exactly the same regions in the brains were activated. And that basically means now that we, for the first time ever, can start claiming that there is some parallels between brands and religions. Not to say that brands are religions, but certainly to say that both of them are activating same or similar areas in the brain.
Hmm. And what about religion and fear, religion and superstition?
Well, I had to jump on a plane almost for 2 years. I traveled around the world to interview religious leaders to understand what are the ground pillars in powerful religions, making them as powerful as they are today. And what I learned was really interesting. Almost every religious leader, and I interviewed 14 different leaders, they all said one thing, that there was 10 elements creating a powerful religion. And guess what? In most of the cases, it was almost identical. And what we learned was that one of the elements here was to have an enemy. So really to have a clear enemy, that comes back to fear if you think about it. Think about almost every religion, not all of them, but almost every one of them, have a powerful enemy. And that's the same with football and with sports in general. Sport is not fun without having a defined enemy. We also learned that rituals are a really strong part of powerful religions. And what's interesting is if I took a ritual and removed the concept of rituals from most religions around the world, guess what? There wouldn't be anything left. Think about Christianity. No prayers, no weddings, no birthdays, no ringing bells, no nothing. Suddenly the whole concept of a religion starts to fall apart. So rituals, along with 10 other elements, actually created the whole list of pillars creating powerful religions. And these are now the pillars which are being adapted to the world of branding.
On the one hand, fear, it seems to me, serves a purpose in that it helps us survive. On the other hand, as FDR said, fear is something to fear.
Yeah. Well, you know, you have to remember that we are hardwired to be seduced by certain things. And let me just do a little test on you. Why don't you, and all the listeners listening to this program right now, why don't you, well, unless you're driving your car, of course, why don't you close your eyes right now? Now, then try to imagine when you're a kid in school and you had those blackboards. Do you remember those old blackboards?
Mm-hmm.
Then you take your long nails and you scratch them down the blackboard. Can you feel it?
Yeah.
Do you know why you feel like that?
Because of all the things that came together in all the senses.
Well, yes and no.
No?
It's actually because when we were monkeys some 100,000 years ago, when we were seeing a danger on the street or whatever it was in those days, then we would scream. And the frequency of that scream is exactly the same frequency as when I scratch my nails down the blackboard.
Mm.
And what's so interesting about this is well, today no one is screaming like that. And yes, I won't see a snake on the street as I did 100,000 years ago. Still yet, we are hardwired to behave like that. And that gives you an indication of how much stuff of everything we do every day is hardwired. And that's the reason why fear, even though we fear fear, is still around, because it really locks us into a certain mood where we become in a survival instinct mood instead.
Yeah. Well, when I was thinking of my senses, I was thinking of that sound. And you actually, it makes you physically cringe.
It does. And that's because, in reality, you are not logically making yourself cringe. That's your subconscious part of the brain saying, hey, that sound reminds me many 100,000 years ago about a danger happening. And then the reason why you get the cringe is basically because we were wearing hair then. And then the hair was raising ourselves because that was our protection to survive in the mood. It's a little bit the same with the dog. When that sees a danger or a cat sees a danger, the hair is picking up. And that's a real, the same was happening for us. Mm. However, in our world, 2009 is not relevant anymore. Still yet, it's happened.
Yeah, well, we can still feel the hairs on the back of our neck sometimes.
We can, yes.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Martin Lindstrom, our guest this afternoon, author of Buyology. That's B-U-Y-ology, Truth and Lies About Why We Buy. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign, line one. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
I'm familiar with some of the research in the insurance industry in terms of direct response offers, and that the issue of level of fear, that it seemed that sometimes if the fear was at a certain level, you know, you'd get quite a bit of response, but then if the fear appeal went too high, the people, whether they turned off or whatever, have you seen the same thing in your research?
You're absolutely right about that, and that's the reason why a lot of the anti-smoking television commercials doesn't work, because they are so fearful, and this is so ironic when I'm saying it, but they are so fearful that people actually have to light up a cigarette to get over the problem they're seeing right now. So, yes, you do have that, you know, tipping point, you could almost call it. And, yes, what happens is when I see fear to that degree that I lock it off. I basically try to resist seeing it or getting near it. And that is what we're seeing happening in Australia, in Canada, in Brazil, and in New Zealand, where they have graphic warnings on the cigarette packs. Those warnings are basically pictures of people with half limbs, with the lungs cut into pieces as a reflection of smoking too much. Guess what's happening? In many of those cases, people are basically not seeing it anymore. They're just locking down. And in the end of the day, it just had the reverse effect, the light of a cigarette. So I think from the insurance industry, this is very much the same. And I think the insurance industry in some countries are going too far. In other countries, even brands are going too far. The other day I saw an ad for Colgate toothpaste, which were claiming that you'll become seriously ill if you're not brushing your teeth and will almost be in the dangers of dying, it claimed, that particular ad. And I think that's probably going a little bit too far.
Now, also, did you do any work? Supposedly they're working, the meth commercials, that, you know, there's been a decrease in the number of people using meth. Did you actually do those at all or not?
Maybe. Well, we have been involved in other TV commercials for anti-drugs, and one of them was an amazing television commercial, which was really, really scary to look at. And again, when we scan consumers' brains as they're watching those scary, scary ads, we learned one thing. The concept worked really well, but they were so scary, so people actually started to take more drugs. So we actually had to go in and remove certain scenes and basically to settle it down a little bit. And guess what? Then it started to work. So exactly as you're indicating from the insurance industry and other industries, that if you find the right balance, it works very well. And I also would say, of course, this is wonderful news if you want to make people quit smoking or quit taking drugs. But of course, from a commercial point of view, we also need to talk about the ethics about using fear, because my stand here is, sometimes you can go far too far, and I think a lot of industries are doing that right now.
Yeah, I think they raised it. I was in the marketing industry for a while. The ethical issue and the previous caller mentioned, manipulation. What do we, and especially when it comes to children, there's a whole issue there too. So what's your perspectives on that?
Well, my perspective is very simple. I'm a consumer too, and the reason why I decided to write biology and I actually wrote it in a very simple language so even my mom can read the book, because I wanted to start a debate around the world, because neuromarketing is one of the fastest growing research techniques right now, and it is incredibly invasive into our privacy if it's not done right. So I wanted to start a debate. My opinion about neuromarketing and the ability to look into the brain is very simple. Neuromarketing is like a hammer. It can be used to hang up a beautiful painting on the wall, or it can be used to destroy people with it. So we need to see a regulation around it. And that regulation really needs to account for not being able to scan kids and not being able to scan certain product categories, so we persuade people to buy more tobacco brands or whatever it is. So I think there needs to be some very strong regulations around it. That said, most importantly, I think we need to hear a debate in the societies, which is exactly the reason why I'm on this show, because we as consumers need to take a stand before it's too late.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Martin Lindstrom, author of Biology, Truth and Lies About Why We Buy. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. He is a road warrior who spends 300 days of the year traveling. A native of Denmark, he makes his home in Australia. In addition to biology, he is the author of Brand Sense, a book hailed by the Wall Street Journal as one of the best marketing books ever published. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Well, speaking of political manipulation, politicians are also interested in neuromarketing. Where are we headed? Will we see a field of neuropolitical science? Will we see neurocampaigns?
I think, to be honest, that it will take a long time before politicians will start to use it as a research tool to find out how to capture the voters. The reason why is because I think they are really petrified of being caught by the public and being seen as manipulating the public to cast a vote for them. So that will probably take some time. But what we will see, however, is that the polling, so that means the ongoing ratings coming up in the media telling how well politicians are performing, those will probably start to be adapted by neuromarketing. And I think we will see by election 2012 that neuromarketing will start to have a very strong a degree of role in the way the pollings are taking place. So when we are watching the AC Nielsen news about who is winning right now, probably neuromarketing will start to have a say in the end results.
Now, you believe political candidates have become brands. When and how did that happen?
Well, actually, it depends on how we define brands, because in my world, I think everything and everyone is a brand, because in reality, you're a brand as long as you're aware of who you are. That means that you and I are both brands. But politicians started to market themselves not just having an opinion about their political direction, but also starting to promote themselves in various directions. That, I believe, was happening already in the 70s. And you will say that John Reagan was probably one of the politicians which were really aware of his presence on the screen, because he was an actor, and therefore he started to adapt some of those acting talents into the way he portrayed himself to the public. And, you know, it's interesting, because if you take a look at the school of journalism in the United States, one of the main cases there is actually when John Reagan was elected. In fact, he had an interview with Leslie Stahl at 60 Minutes. I'm not sure if it was at 60 Minutes those days. But she told me personally that when she was interviewing Ronald Reagan, she actually had a very tough interview with him. And in the end of the day, she was afraid of what they would say. And in the end of the day, they actually said to her, listen, we were really delighted about the interview. And she said, why? And he said, well, because the pictures behind the candidates of John Reagan was so amazing. They were so seductive. as a doctor in the end of the day, that people really didn't hear the interview. They just watched the pictures and they felt he was the hero. And I think this is very much a reflection of how politics works today, that they are very aware of the words used, the pictures used, and in particular the sound used. So this has become one big setting of a stage for Hollywood.
Mm. Well, let's talk a little bit now about subliminal advertising. You say it's there, although it goes by other names today, including primes and visual drumbeats. And you wanted to know, when you set out on this big marketing study, does it work? How did you go about exploring the question?
Well, what I wanted to find out was how come, again, we're smoking more, not less. So one of the things we did was to look into Marlboro. Marlboro, as you know, is one of the most popular cigarette brands in the world. And actually, they're not allowed to advertise around the world, and they're hardly allowed to sponsor anything, including the Formula One. Formula One in Europe is similar to NASCAR race. It's a very popular racing ratio. And what's interesting is that that ratio has been sponsored by Marlboro for many years. Recently, suddenly, the logo, however, disappeared from the racing cars. And what was interesting was we decided to scan those cars, the Ferrari cars, and then expose them for smokers as they're lying in the scanners. Now, here's what we realized. When people are watching a Ferrari car, just one of those innocent cars, we learned that this was one of the most powerful tools to encourage people to smoke more. There was no logos on them, no nothing, just a photo of a car. We also went one step further and put up fake billboards across the country. One billboard with a logo on, the other billboard without the logo, but still a photo of a cowboy. Guess what? When people passed by and there was no logo on it, the effect was double as in comparison when there was a logo on. And that's the first time ever we learned that the power of the logo is diminishing. In reality, people are much more seductive or seduced when they are exposed for indirect signals rather than direct signals.
Hmm. We can read biology, your book, but how else can we start to look at our world and our day and do some useful editing?
I think the most important thing is for us to learn the daily tricks when we're going out shopping, because that's really where the battle is happening. So let me just give you some advice. I think the most important thing is, and I know it sounds really silly when I'm telling you, but it really is important. Don't be hungry when you go out shopping. What we learned is that if you are hungry, you not only buy more food, you actually buy more electronic stuff, you buy more clothing items, you buy more computer games, you buy more everything. And that's just because you are hungry. So don't be hungry. The second thing you should be aware of when you walk down the supermarket aisles is that they are going to play a word game on you, and you're not even aware of it. We did an experiment in Europe some time ago where we had cans of soups placed in a very big pile. We had an offer on top of it saying $1.95 for one can of soup. No one bought anything. Then the day after, we had a little footnote below the price saying maximum 8 cans per customer. Guess what? Everyone was rushing to the counter with those cans of soup. And that's what I call a word game. That's similar to when you buy a bag of strawberries. It may be cost $25 for this whole bag, but if you split it into two bags, and then instead you're saying two bags, and they cost 12 and a half each, but you get them both for the price of 25, you actually feel you're getting more.
Oh.
And that's a little bit what we're fooled by every day. That's still the reason why you can buy stuff costing $9.95. Even though we know it's $10, we still try to persuade ourselves that it's only $9. So what we learned is that word game has an enormous effect on seducing us to buy more. And I think the last point I want to give you of advice if you want to avoid spending too many money is to avoid taking the trolley or the shopping basket. Because what we learned is that if the basket is actually double the size of what it used to be, you are spending 30% more money. So basically, you're putting more product down in your basket as you're shopping because you feel there's much more space and you feel you haven't bought a lot. And in the end of the day, you've bought much more. So don't grab that trolley. Make sure you are not hungry and be alert on those word games.
Hmm. And try and cut down on the stress in your life, too.
Well, that's another point. Yeah. I think the stress factor is very sad, because I think we as human beings, when we're under stress, what actually happens is that we are creating rituals around ourselves. Now, rituals are incredibly powerful, because that's the way we create space. That's the reason why in our latest research study, we can now see that people are executing many more rituals than they did just a year ago. In average, an average American is actually executing 200 rituals every day, and that is increasing right now with 10% during the recession, because that's a way for us to create space. And that's the reason why, by the way, brands are now starting to embed rituals into the products in order to persuade us to use that product or consume that product even more.
Well, what do you mean by a ritual?
Well, a ritual is like the Corona beer ritual. You know, the Corona beer would have a lime squeezed down the bottleneck.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that ritual, you know, some people believe it's coming from Mexico in order to keep the flies away. But some other people, and we've had that confirmed in some of the interviews we've done for the biology project, actually now state that it comes from California, where in 1981, two bartenders were betting on how fast a ritual can spread around the world. Now, no matter what the truth is, what's interesting is that Corona beer is the largest import beer into the United States. And the main reason is because you're squeezing a lime down the bottle.
Fascinating. It's not very good beer.
Well, that's what some people are saying, that that's the reason why you put the lime down in it.
Ah.
Bit of that, but that may be an argument number three.
Yeah. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign County, line one. Good afternoon.
Hi. Regarding the advertising of pharmaceuticals, it's part of the American exception. Maybe you can confirm that the U.S. is the only country that allows this kind of advertising, and there are a lot of complexities there, it seems like, because they are playing on the fear of bad health, except for Viagra, and the erectile dysfunction ones are obviously, they use the muted tones, et cetera. But what can you say about that? Because obviously if smoking cautions and meth cautions and all that shut down a response that allows it to change behavior. How do the pharmaceuticals get around that? Or maybe it is they're wasting a bunch of money, which is actually adding to our health costs, of course, but not doing them much good. I'm not sure. What can you say about that?
Well, I have a very ambivalent relationship to that particular topic. First of all, you are right. The United States is one of the very few countries in the world where you're allowed to advertise for pharmaceutical products both over-the-counter and per reception. In Australia, you would actually see similar ads, but they will not go further than just advertising headache products and so forth. But what's interesting about this is that there's no doubt about that the huge volume of pharmaceutical ads on television is the main reason why the consumption, at least in my mind, is so high here in the United States. I do think that people have got a relationship with it where they think that any problem you have really means that you can just take a pill against it. And if you just feel you don't feel very good, then we can give you a pill which is making you feel a little bit better. And that feeling is highly unusual for the rest of the world. You will not see that very relaxed relationship to pharmaceutical products in other countries, with very few exceptions. So I do think that the pharmaceutical ads have enormous say in getting to the point where it is right now. Fear is a very prominent factor. And it may be it's not that fearful that you don't dare to watch the ad, but fear is indirect. Fear is where they're saying, well, would you like to have some sad days in your life and stuff like that, or would you like to have happy days in your life? That is another way of using fear in order to promote a brand or a product. So my opinion is very simple around this. I think that the pharmaceutical industry is incredibly good at what they're doing. We probably, however, as consumers, should ask ourselves if pharmaceutical products is the answer to everything. And my opinion is very simple. It's not. But that's another, I guess, another conversation.
You must have quite an ambivalence to the entire your entire way you get a living, because you're writing a book that's critical of it. I don't know what it seems to me that the easy case is to say there shouldn't be advertising pharmaceuticals because of the irrationality you've referred to in decision making. I was curious in one specific example, and I don't know if you've seen it, but I guess it's Pfizer has the anti-smoking drug Chantix, which has been a bit controversial. Their ads don't even mention the product. Is that because, can you you say anything about that specifically?
Well, I haven't seen the specific ad you're referring back to, but what I would say is that it could be that they're using a technology or a technique which I call smash your brand. The Coca-Cola bottle was invented in 1915, and the original brief was to develop a bottle which is so smart that if you drop it on the floor and it smashes into thousands of pieces of glass, you can still pick up one piece of glass and recognize the brand. Now, the reason why I tell you this story is because a lot of brands now are using that mythology, which I invented some years ago, that is basically just to use a color, a shape, or a sound, and because of those indirect signals telling a story about the brand. And what we learned now is that those indirect signals are actually much more powerful than direct signals. And that may be the technique that Pfizer's are using, that they, in principle, are selling indirect signals. So people are very aware of what brand it is, but they don't need to say who they are. And if you do that really smartly, you're actually bypassing the regulations in terms of what you're allowed to and not. Because most pharmaceutical products are, you know, forced to come up with a lot of legal disclaimers before and after they've shown the ad. And if you really don't have a name on it, well, then you don't need to say anything. So that may be one of the reasons why they're doing it. But let me just stress, I haven't seen the ad, and I don't know the reason why they did it. But that's certainly one of the theories which could be out there.
I want to thank the listener for his call. I've got a couple other folks waiting. Let's go next to a listener on line two in Champaign. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Fascinating discussion. I've just caught not even 5 minutes of this, and find it very fascinating. I am in the marketing field, advertising field, and some of the stuff I'm quite aware of, and I do agree that there are a lot of companies, and pharmaceutical companies certainly one of them, that take advantage of their consumers. And by the way, your suggestions about not shopping hungry are very well founded. But I did want to bring another point up that I don't know if you've discussed it or if it's even related. One of the things that I find particularly interesting, and it's a pet peeve I got, I think, from my mother, who was always concerned about spending or squirting too much dish detergent in her sink while she was washing her dishes. And I look at today an example of like laundry detergent that now they're reducing sizes for to be able to put more products on the shopping shelves in the grocery store, and saying that they're concentrated, but it's very ambiguous, the lines and the caps, and you would easily overfill it, and it's kind of a perception thing, and I wonder if that's something that you study and have looked into.
Definitely, and it's a very good point you're raising. Let me just take you one step back. When Coca-Cola released the 1.5-liter bottle in Europe and whatever size it is across the world, we realized that the larger the bottles are, the more we actually consume. What was interesting was the Coca-Cola company thought that the larger bottle, the less you would consume because then you had more Coke in the fridge so you wouldn't buy as much. But it's actually opposite, and that's the reason why when the shopping baskets are bigger, you actually buy more. And coming back to you, what's interesting is we do have a tactile relationship with those different dishwashing powder systems. So if I've over the years taught myself that when I do my dishwashing that I had to put in a certain amount of powder into the machine, then I won't change that because it becomes kind of a ritual for me. It's a little bit the same as handshaking people. I'm not changing that if I'm told to. I'll do it the same way all the time. And if the ads are telling me this is highly concentrated, I would, on the rational part of the brain, say to myself, hey, I want to buy more of this because it's extra value in it. But my tactile relationship or the rituals, which is the subconscious part of the brain, will say, hey, it's not enough. It won't work. You won't get this very perfect glinty glasses as I want to, so I'll put in the same amount as I did previously. So in reality, it's a very good way of fooling you and in the end of the day justify increasing the price of the product. And that's exactly a technique which has been used a lot by companies across the world.
Yeah, that's quite fascinating, quite fascinating. I'm going to hold on and I'm going to get off the air and listen, but thank you for your comments.
You are welcome.
Thanks for the call, and we'll take one more call this afternoon. Champaign, line three, hi.
Hi, interesting topic. I'd like the young man to talk about what's happening in the economy, the ill economy that we're seeing not only nationally but globally, and what effect that will have on marketing strategies in the future. And by the way, Corona is a pretty good beer.
Okay.
Well, thanks for the hint regarding the beer. This, what is going to happen, I think, from a marketing point of view, is very simple. We as consumers will not go out and buy stuff anymore without there's some sort of good bargain or a special deal attached to it. Because if we don't get a good deal, we'll be seen as being stupid to go out and buy that product. So what the advertisers are going to do from now on is not just to give you discount. They're going to go in the opposite way, and they're going to bundle products. That means if you're buying a handbag, for example, for your wife, you may actually get a free wallet on top of it. It may be they're not discounting the handbag, but they're giving you a free wallet instead. And that's the way for them to get around the problem, which is really strong in the advertising business, and that is you don't want to discount your brand over time. Because if I discount a brand too much, guess what? When the recession is over 2 years from now on, let's hope that at least, well, then I can't recover my price again. And we do know it takes about 7 years to recover a price from a discount. So what they would like to do is to make it very difficult for you to look through the true price. And they still want to give you a good deal, but it will be an indirect deal rather than direct deal. And that is going to be one of the strategies. I advise companies to increase the marketing spend right now, not to decrease it, even though the majority is decreasing it. And the reason why you should increase it now is because no one is advertising out there. So the value for money you get as an advertiser, no matter if you're a small company or a big company, is so much better than anything else. So this is a wonderful time to start a release of your new brand, and it's even better to advertise for your existing products.
Mm. And the newspaper industry thanks you, Martin.
Well, you know, take a look at New York Times.
Yeah.
Even today, they have now an ad on the
front page.
We've never seen that before. So you will get the ads at a cheaper price right now. So it's a good deal. In particular, if you're a small company and you have, you know, a problem surviving, spend the money in advertising. This is the time to do it.
There we have to leave it. We have to wrap up. Martin Lindstrom, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
You're welcome.
Martin Lindstrom is the author most recently of Buyology. That's B-U-Y-ology, Truth and Lies About Why We Buy. The publisher, Doubleday. You'll find our guest online at www.martinlindstrom.com. And that interview was conducted on January 12th of this year. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. It's 1:53 Central Time. Todd Gleason is standing by with settlement prices from Chicago and Kansas City. And following those numbers, we'll have settlement prices today from the livestock contracts. What happened there today? As the day progressed, it was a strong day in Kansas City and Chicago. Here with all the details, Todd Gleason.
Well, Celeste, I gave Todd the whole week off, dog.
Ah, well, you didn't tell me.
No, I didn't. I'm sorry about that. However, we do have the market prices for you. It was a market that started the day with a bang and sort of ended it with a whimper, both wheat and corn giving back all the gains it saw on the day to finish in negative territory, while the soybeans finished marginally higher. Let's look at the particulars. In Kansas City, May wheat a high on the day of 613, a low of 597 and a quarter, settling 604 up 1. July, a high of 624, a low of 609, settling 614 and 3 quarters, up 3 quarters. May wheat at the board of trade, the high there 563, the low 545, settling 549 and a quarter, down 1. July, a high of 575, a low of 557 and 3 quarters, settling 561 and 3 quarters, down 3 quarters. December wheat, a high of 621, a low of 604 and a half, settling 608, down 3 quarters. Let's take it out to May of 2010, where we didn't see any trades there on the day, but in the July, we go a little further out. We see 640 and 3 quarters the high, the low 630 and a quarter, and settling 632 and 3 quarters, down a quarter on the day. May corn, a high of 403 and 3 quarters, a low of 392 and a half, settling 395 and a half, down 1. July, a high of 414, a low of 403 and a half, settling 406, down 1. December, a high of 434 and 3 quarters, a low of 424 and a half, settling 427 and a quarter, down 3 quarters. March of 2010, a high of 445, a low of 436 and a half, settling 438 and a half, down 3/4. May, a high of 450 and a half, a low of 445 and a quarter, settling 444 and a half, down 3/4. July of 2010, a high of 456, a low of 450, settling on its low, down 3/4 on the day. May Oats, a high of 202 and a half, a low of 198 and 3/4, settling 199 and a half, down a half. The July contract also a half on the day, that the downside, and it's a high 211 and a quarter, the low 207 and a half, the settlement 208 and a quarter. May Beans, a high of 981 and a quarter, a low of 951 and a half, settling 955 and a half, up 3 and a half. July, a high of 978 and a half, a low of 948 and a quarter, settling 952, up 3. August, a high of 961, a low of 935, settling 936 and a half, up 4. November, a high of 914 and 3/4, a low of 891 and a quarter, settling 895 and a half, up 2 and a half. January of 2010, a high of 923 and a quarter, a low of $9, settling 906 and a half, up 3 and a half. May, a high of 937, a low of 920, settling 918, up 1. And take it out to November of 2010, a high of 940, a low of 926, settling 922 and a quarter, up 3/4 on the day. May soybean meal, a high of 309, a low of 297, settling 298.40, and it was down $2.10. The July contract off the same, 210 on a high of 304, a low of 292.40, and settling 293.70. May soybean oil, a high of 33.45, a low of 32.26, settling 33.10, up 85 cents. The July, a high of 33.73, a low of 32.53, settling 33.39, up 87 cents on the day. Don't forget to tune in at 2:06 for the closing market report. Our analyst will be Pete Manhard of Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. We'll have the settlements in just a second from CME Livestock. This is Dave Dickey.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
The cattle contracts finished higher on the day today while lean hogs were lower. April live cattle, 86.05 the high, 85.30 the low. The settlement, 85.95, up 75. June, 83.80 the high, 83.02 and a half the low, 83.40 the settlement, that up 55. August, 84.85 the high, 84.10 the low, finishing at 84.40, up 32 and a half. October, 88.40 the high, 87.90 the low, the settlement, 88.07 and a half, up 35. March feeder cattle, 94.10 the high, 93.60 the low, 94 even the settlement, that up 32 and a half. April, 94.95 the high, 94 even the low, 94.45 the settlement, that up 67 and a half. May, 96.45 the high, 95.50 the low, 96.05 the settlement, that up 67 and a half. August, 99.25 the high, 98.50 the low, the settlement, 99.17 and a half, that up 95. April lean hog, 61.85 the high, 59.75 the low, 60.65 the settlement, that down 110. May, 73 even the high, 71.40 the low, 71.90 the settlement, that down 140. June, 74.15 the high, 71.60 the low, 72.62 and a half the settlement, that down 115. July lean hog, 75 even the high, the low, 72.60 the settlement, 73.32 and a half, that down 122 and a half. And May bellies were down $3 today, 90.90 the high, 88.50 the low, and the settlement, that down $3. The Dow is currently up 370 points at 76.48, the NASDAQ up 69 at 15.27, the S&P 500 41 higher at 8.10, the price of crude oil nearby month down 55 at 51.06, that trading in New York. It's 2 o'clock. This is WIL.